All right, this meeting of the House Health and Social Services Committee will now come to order. It is 3:08 p.m. on Thursday, May 2nd in Capitol Room 106. And members present are Representative Jackson, Klayman, Representative Zolkowski, co-chair, Representative Tarr, and myself, Representative Sponholz, co-chair. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Take a moment to silence your cell phones if you haven't already for the duration of the meeting. Thank you. Before we begin, I want to thank Julia Bushman, the House Hess Secretary from Records, and Doug Bridges from the LIO for staffing the committee today, as well as Ted Madsen and Katie Giorgio, our Hess Committee aides. Today we have one item on the agenda, and that's House Bill 92 by Representative Johnston, covering direct care agreements. And I believe that we have a CS to bring before the committee, and I want to see if there's a motion.
Madam Chair, I move that the Health and Social Services Committee adopt the blank committee substitute for House Bill 92, work order number 31-LS0243/E as a working document.
Are there any objections? All right, seeing none, the committee substitute has been adopted. And with that, we'll invite Aaron Shine, staff to Representative Johnston up to speak to the CS.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the House Health and Social Services Committee. For the record, my name is Aaron Shine, and I am staff to Representative Jennifer Johnston, District 28. The CS you have before you makes some changes from the previous version, and I will walk those through as I go through the sectional. I will try and outline what has changed from the previous version and what is new sections. So version E is still maintaining the underlying intent of the bill to exempt direct primary or direct practices from the definition of insurance. The major changes between version U and version E are, one, that it limits to direct primary care, and the second is the removal from version U, the sections 2 through 7, which was the mandatory Medicare, Medicaid participation. There are also additional changes and new sections that respond to some of the concerns that we heard in the last hearing for transparency and for consumer protections. So that with that, Madam Chair, I can start on the sectional.
Please do.
So on page one, line one and two, this is an updated title to identify that it's direct primary care, and also removes the medical assistant recipients, which is the Medicare Medicaid language. It also adds intent for to the title that it's relating to the Alaska Unfair Trade Practices and Consumer Protections Act. Moving on to the section one, previously in version U, this was actually a subsection, while in version E, this is a new whole section. It creates a title.
Welcome to Representative Johnston.
So the new title is for 2103031 for direct primary care agreements. For this exempts direct primary care agreements from the application of Title 21 relating to insurance if a written health care agreement contains the following information. It describes the services provided in exchange for a periodic fee. It allows either party to terminate the agreement as long as 60 days notice is given. It clearly states that the agreement is not health insurance and is in at least 12-point font in plain language, and prohibits the provider from receiving additional compensation for the services rendered. In this section A of subsection A of section 1, I'd just like to point out where the changes are from the previous version. This again limits it to direct primary agreements. As well, if you go to page 2, line 7 and 8, this is a new subsection, number 5, and that is the language is written in font not smaller than 12 points and in plain language that an individual with no medical training can understand. This was added in response to some of the transparency and making sure that the consumer understands what's written in the agreement. Moving on page 2, line 12, subsection B, This is a new section, and it applies to consumer protections established under AS 4545915. Moving on to subsection C on line 14, this is all new language for subsection C, and it requires direct primary care providers to submit the following information to the Division of Insurance no later than September 1st of each year, which includes the number of providers in a practice, the provider's capacity for direct primary care patients, the number of direct primary care patients and periodic fees paid for the prescribing calendar or preceding calendar year, and any other information requested by the division. Subsection for D on here on page 2, line 26, defines healthcare practices and healthcare provider for purposes of this section. The change between the previous version and this current version, we've added number 2, which is healthcare practice. This definition was not included in the previous version. Moving to section number 2, which is on page 3, line 5, everything after this point is new language to this bill. So section 2 is for direct primary care agreements for health care. This is adding a new section restricting a direct primary care provider from terminating agreements solely based on health status or declining to accept a new patient unless the practice has received their maximum capacity of patients or is unable to provide the level of care required by the patient. And for this also provides definitions and citations for the definitions of direct primary care agreement and healthcare provider. Moving on to section 3, which is on page 3, line 21. This is adding a new violation under the unfair trade practices and consumer protections for violating AS 4545915. With that, Madam Chair, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Ms. Sinder, the bill sponsor? All right, Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I did want to understand why the part about Medicaid and Medicare came out of the bill.
Mm-hmm. Through the chair, Representative Tarr, I think we were trying to simplify the bill, understanding that right now it is unclear what is available for the state to be able to have Medicaid patients be in agreements for Medicaid to pay for them. That's not to say it's something that we're not still looking at. Just after we ordered this draft, CMS issued guidance, and I know that Deputy Commissioner Donna Stewart, I think, is online. She might be able to speak to some of that new guidance or some of the new opportunities. We would also be the first state in the nation to require Medicaid patients to be accepted for a practice to be able to set up for a direct primary care practice. I think that it's one of the access issues that I think this committee is concerned with, and it's something that we are also concerned with, which is why we included it in the first version of the bill. But I think that the conversation needs to be had a little bit more in a robust where the state's going with Medicaid and how these patients might be able to interact with some of these practices if they were to exist in Alaska.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And so if I understand this correctly, are you saying that the actual like billing code potentially for this service doesn't exist yet in Medicaid, and so it'd be unclear if you had a Medicaid enrollee whether they could actually participate and have it covered by Medicaid?
Through the chair, Representative Tarr, I think it's unclear on how we would need to interact with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services on how this would be paid for. I believe that you could look at it through like an HMO, a health management organization, or other maybe innovation models that might be available. We didn't narrow down on one, and so we wanted to step back, but also understand that it was quite cumbersome how we had it in the bill previously. There were 7 sections, and almost all of them were conditional language based off of approval from CMS. So we want to make sure that we're getting it right as we move forward.
Did we want to go to Donna Stewart? Ms. Stewart? Are you on the phone? Are you on the phone? Did you hear the question?
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Tarr, going back to your previous question about potentially what might be involved, the situation with CMS is what they have offered an opportunity for the Medicare program to have models that move forward that look at direct primary care. They've not necessarily extended the same modeling to the Medicaid program, but all that means is in order for us to move forward, we would need to engage with a demonstration waiver, so an 1115 waiver, sketch out what it is that we are hoping will you know, be accomplished through moving through that process, and then beginning that negotiation with CMS to potentially adopt both a new provider type and then a new way to bill for that service. Right now, in fee-for-service Medicaid programs, which Alaska, that is the design for our program, we are not allowed to prepay for a service. And so at this point, that is kind of how the direct primary care is viewed, because we would be paying a monthly fee for a service that potentially the individual may not need that month. And so it just needs to be a negotiation through that waiver process in order to develop the new provider type, how the structure would work, and then get the payment mechanism and model in place.
Thank you. All right. Co-Chair Zlokowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I just want to distill it down for how I understand it based on conversations with the Division of Insurance and the sponsor's office. From what I recall, that particular language about the Medicaid percentage within the bill becomes problematic because the way that we structure, the way that Alaska's Medicaid payment structure is currently established as opposed to how it's established in Washington is different. Is that correct? Just like Ms. Stewart was saying, is that it's in a managed care payment plan in Washington, whereas Alaska is fee-for-service?
Through the Chair, Representative Zlokowski, that is my understanding. We are still fee-for-service in Alaska, although there are, I think, demonstration projects that might be coming online for Medicaid that are managed care forms of payment, but we are still fee-for-service. I believe that there are other states that do have participation from Medicaid in direct primary care. But I don't believe it's available to us currently.
Thank you. Representative Klayman.
So I want to turn your attention to Section 3 of the bill about the Uniform, the Unfair Trade Practices and Consumer Protection Act. What portion of the services that would be provided by one of these providers would be subject to the UTPA?
Through the Chair, Representative Klayman, I believe it would have to be governed by what's in the contract between the provider and the patient. This is consumer protection language that I worked with the Department of Law to add to respond to some of the consumer protections. I think it might be whatever might have been breached within the contract if they fail to reimburse or if they fail to provide the services or whatever's in the contract is.
Well, let me ask it. Let me ask.
Follow up.
Thank you. Apologize for not questioning. So, is it if you go to a provider, primary care provider, and there's an allegation that the services provided constitute malpractice? Would this provision mean that the malpractice claim that might be brought against the provider would be subject to the treble damages provisions of the Unfair Trade Practices and Consumer Protection Act?
Through the Chair, Representative Klayman, from my understanding, they would be different. For malpractice would be in a different section. This is what governs the contract. However, that being said, I know that Cynthia Franklin is online or potentially here, might be able to clearly identify what would be covered under this new section that would be added onto the Trade Act.
Is she available?
I am not sure that Cynthia Franklin is online.
So through the Chair, Representative Klayman, I'm going to have to get back to you on a clear answer on that. I believe that anything that happens currently under practice would, for medical malpractice, would still be covered in the same way. This is adding a section specifically to these direct primary care agreements so that if there is a consumer complaint, that there is something within the Consumer Protection Unit that has the authority to be able to address them. But I will clarify.
Mm-hmm. Follow up?
So the suggestion is that, I'm just trying to think this through, that if there was a if there's an argument that they were supposed to provide a certain amount of services as a function of the contract, and the failure to provide those services, say, for example, prescription medication was part of their contract, and they didn't provide consumer medication, or that the medication that was covered by it, then there'd be a claim under the Deceptive Trade Practices Act for the failure to provide the medication, but the treatment itself wouldn't be covered.
Through the chair, Representative Clayman, that's how I believe that it is set up. I believe if there was malpractice within the process of providing the medication that is outside of what is would be constituted as malpractice, that would be under a different section. But again, I will clarify that and get back to you.
So, follow up?
Follow up.
So just by comparison, let's say we've got a clinic that is not one of these participating groups, but they nevertheless, when somebody comes in, a primary care group, it's just whatever primary care group I happen to see, and I sign a contract when I come in to see them, and it's their standard thing they give to everybody that signs it in, but it isn't something that has a little bit of a look like insurance or kind of a HMO type structure. Would that provider be subject to the provisions of the Unfair Trade Practices Act?
Through the chair, Representative Clayman, I do not believe so, because it would not be a direct primary care practice, and those contracts would not be. But I will verify.
Larry Winghire seems to be getting up. So,
Madam Chair, if you'd like, I think Director Winghire might be able to answer that.
All right. So, yeah, we're going to, so just so everybody is aware, we're going to bring in Cynthia Franklin, who's the Assistant Attorney General for the Consumer Protection Division of the Department of Law. She's dialing in right now, so maybe we'll just take a quick moment while we wait for her. I think this is an important line of inquiry. Back on the record, and we have Cynthia Franklin, Assistant Attorney General for the Consumer Protection Section of Department of Law. Do we want to reiterate the question for Ms. Franklin's edification?
I can start the framework again. Ms. Franklin, this is Representative Clayman. I'm looking at Section 3 of the bill that's adding provisions into the Unfair Trade Practices and Consumer Protection Act, and I'm very much aware of the treble damages provisions of that act. How does this provision potentially impact the medical services provided? I'm specifically asking, if you've got a malpractice situation and an allegation against a clinic that has one of these contracts in place, does this open up the care provided to a treble damages claim?
Representative Clayman, through the chair, thank you. This is Cynthia Franklin at the Attorney General's office in Anchorage, and I believe that the treble damages section in the Unfair Trade Practices Act belongs to individual litigants alone. And so in terms of any kind of an action by the state under the Unfair Trade Practices Act, the civil penalty section trumps the treble damages section. So the interaction would be between a consumer's individual UTP lawsuit against the clinic or provider, mm-hmm. and their medical malpractice claim. And how those two legal claims would interact would be a question for a private attorney, but the unfair trade practices claim damages would be limited to whatever damages arose from the violations of the section of the direct primary care provider statute. So if the statute is passed, they would be limited to claim damages to whatever actions by the clinic violated a section of that statute, if that makes sense.
Do you have a follow-up?
I do have a follow-up, but I can't say as I really understood the answer. So if I'm a patient of the clinic and I sign a contract with that clinic to provide services at $100 a month or whatever the monthly fee I pay to come as often as I want, and then in this instance, well, it's not me, but say my wife has a child with the clinic and I believe there was malpractice committed in the course of delivering that child, does that mean I have a malpractice claim under the contract? And if you don't know, that's fine.
Representative Clayman, through the chair, I I don't know how the malpractice claim would interact with the contract, but I don't believe that Section 3 and the patient's individual lawsuit under the UTP would come into play in that scenario.
Follow up.
Do you see this Section 2 and Section 3 more giving the Division of Insurance the ability to supervise and regulate as a governmental matter what the clinic's doing, or what are these two sections of the bill doing?
Representative Klayman, through the chair, it's my understanding that Section 3 is added because the prohibition on, the lack of characterization of this type of provider care as insurance would prevent the Division of Insurance from regulating, and in most circumstances when we have some kind of consumer transaction and there's no other regulating authority, it falls under the Unfair Trade Practices Act and is added as a section here. So it in terms of governmental regulation, it defaults to the Department of Law and the Attorney General's office to monitor consumer complaints on a business and determine whether or not any of the actions complained of violate any section of the Unfair Trade Practices Act. In this case, it would include sections 1 and 2 of the bill in front of you. And so we as AGs would evaluate whether the complained of conduct violated sections 1 and 2, and then theoretically could, if there was a pattern of conduct on a particular clinic or provider that was cheating, so to speak, or, you know, not playing by those rules that are set out in sections 1 and 2, then theoretically we could bring a state action in Superior Court seeking civil penalties for the business violating those other sections, and that would act as sort of the governmental regulatory authority. But because it's placed in the Unfair Trade Practices Act, it also gives individual patients as consumers of the services individual rights of action under the Act.
Does that answer your question? You can follow up with additional questions later if you'd like.
That's fine.
There's some additional people that are in
That's
the
fine.
Queue. All right. Representative Jackson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I like the fact that you did remove the Medicaid, Medicare out of this. And I say that because this is like a new business, fulfilling needs of people that kind of fall through the ranks of, you know, Medicaid. They make too much, but for regular insurance, it's too expensive. So I see this bill fulfilling a need for patients for affordable care, as well as for the entrepreneurial side with physicians. And so one question with that said, like, I don't like the fact that we will tell them that they have to have 20% of your patients Medicaid. So I'm wondering if Medicaid patients want to use this service, because the problem was they couldn't, Medicaid does not pay before the service, right? But if a Medicaid patient wanted to see, would Medicaid be in position to reimburse their patient if that's the care that they want to receive? Because Epiphany from Florida, that does this business, he said that Medicaid patients paid to go and see them and did not use their Medicaid. So I'm just wondering, for the sake of, you know, everybody here that want Medicaid to be a part of this, is this an option that a Medicaid patient can get reimbursed if this is a service they want to use? That's all.
So, Representative Jackson, through the chair, Florida has a different program for their Medicaid expansion group. And in fact, in another bill that has come before us, there is interest for this state to have a plan similar to help people as they get off Medicaid expansion. But it is a plan, we do not have it currently, and it's a plan that requires the patient to pay some amount. And that's why in Florida, this does work with the Medicaid program, but it does not work here.
May I follow up?
Mm-hmm.
No, from my understanding, the doctors, they did not receive Medicaid insurance at all. What he was saying, that the people that were under Medicaid, they liked the service and care that they were willing to pay to go to Epiphany, if that's the name the business was.
Do you want to answer that?
Yeah.
Address that?
Madam Chair, if I might, through the Chair, Representative Jackson, I think in every state it's going to be a little bit different. Like we said earlier, Medicaid currently is not set up to pay these fees, and it depends on, I think it's not targeted at one population. These are direct primary care agreements. I think you'll hear through testimony from other states and how it's worked that I think that there are people that have Medicaid, people that have Medicare, people that are uninsured, people that have employer-sponsored or exchange insurance that are accessing direct primary care. We included that language to make sure that Medicaid, Medicare patients were not excluded from them. I think it is still part of the conversation, but it is not in the bill.
And I'll just clarify for everybody that we have a series of invited testifiers, both from Washington State, where they've had direct care agreements in law since 2007, as well as some direct care providers, some providers that participate in direct care agreements from other states in a little bit, and so there'll be a lot of opportunities to hear about how they work in other states. Co-Chair Zlokowski.
Thank you. This is a follow-up question for Ms. Franklin based on the series of questions and back and forth with Representative Klayman. I will not try to attempt to be able to interpret legal language in the same way that attorneys are able to have that conversation. So I guess I just want to clarify what I thought I heard, which is that Section 3, as it relates to the unfair trade practices protections, that any claims that would result out of a direct care agreement would likely be limited to damages under that particular section that were violated through the agreement and not related to malpractice damages. Did I understand that correctly?
Representative, through the chair, I think an individual patient would have both claims. In other words, the unfair trade practices claim would be unrelated to the medical malpractice claim because the medical malpractice claim has to do with the quality of the professional treatment. The unfair trade practice claim would be a claim that that something about the business setup or the billing violated the Unfair Trade Practices Act or violated sections 1 or 2.
Follow up.
So in highlighting the unfair trade practices in Section 3 does not withhold or hold harmless any particular direct care agreement from malpractice claims?
Correct.
Okay,
thank
you.
Through the chair, correct.
All right, fantastic. Representative Klayman?
So I want to go back to just make sure I'm understanding. If the department, the Consumer Protection Department of the Attorney General's Office, were to bring a claim related to this addition of these primary care agreements to the Consumer Protection Act, that would be limited to the kinds of issues that are listed in Section 1 of the bill, which is kind of the terms of the contract itself and whether they change the terms in the midst of the agreement, or well, actually describe what sort of things that consumer protection would be looking into in the event that there were consumer protection complaints to the department.
Representative Klayman, through the chair, correct.
Can you give me a follow-up?
Mm-hmm.
Can you describe a what kind of complaints those might be.
Representative Clayman, through the chair, I discussed with this with Director Wienheyer and reviewing the bill in preparation, and it really would be a situation where a particular clinic was advertising services at some rate or advertising services in a particular way so as to attract consumers to that business in competition with other businesses, and then was somehow misleading or deceptive in the way that the contract was presented, in the way that the consumer was attracted to the business or was treated by the business, in opposition to the way that the statute requires the business to operate. So we would look in the situation of a state action against a business like this, we would be looking for a pattern of multiple consumers where it appeared that the business, in their business model, the primary care provider was attempting to get an edge up on their competition by appearing to offer something they didn't really offer, or appearing to have rates that were substantially lower, or that's really the kind of business behavior that we see and investigate here in consumer protection.
Follow up? Mm-hmm. So they, it sounds like in broad terms, it's they're more like kind of a either a false or deceptive advertising, and what they advertised and what they delivered weren't the same thing, that kind of investigation.
Representative Clayman, through the chair, yes, that's typical.
Follow-up? Mm-hmm. Am I correct that the Consumer Protection Department doesn't get involved in medical malpractice claims?
Representative Clayman, through the chair, correct.
And I hope
follow up.
I hope it's the last follow up. But it is your view that because they would be subject, because they would now be included in the consumer in the Deceptive Trade Practices Act or Unfair Trade Practices Act, that would mean in an individual complaint for malpractice against the clinic, the Unfair Trade Practices Act provisions would now apply to that individual complaint against the provider.
Representative Clayman, through the chair, yes. I mean, I believe if you picture a complaint by an individual patient against a physician, say, in a direct primary care practice, should the bill pass, that the complaint could have counts that were medical malpractice, and then the attorney representing that patient after the passage of this bill could theoretically, if they had evidence of violations of Section 1 or 2, add an unfair trade practice complaint on behalf of that patient. So it to me, as an attorney sitting here now looking at the bill, it would provide additional counts or additional potential claims.
Thank you.
All right. Ms. Franklin, this is Co-Chair Sponholz. You described that a little bit, I guess. You said that the Department of Law's Consumer Protection Division might take action if, you know, multiple claims of breaking, you know, not complying with consumer protection were available. How would those typically get brought to the Department of Law?
Co-Chair Sponholz, we initially start out by receiving consumer complaints at an individual level. We have a mediation practice where we invite consumers to complain so that we're aware of issues across the state that involve consumer issues. And then if we receive multiple complaints on the same business, sometimes we open an investigation under those circumstances. On other occasions, other agencies or professional licensing boards will bring matters to our attention. So there's really all kinds of reasons to open an investigation. Our legal standard is when the Attorney General has reason to believe that the Unfair Trade Practices Act has been violated.
So you have, there are opportunities for, are these typically attorneys or are these members of the public that come to you with a concern about unfair trade practices?
Co-Chair Sponholz, they're individual consumers. They're anyone filing a complaint with us.
All right. We also, just for the committee's knowledge, also, in addition to Ms. Donna Stewart, with Health and Social Services and Cynthia Franklin from Department of Law. We also have Lori Wing Heyer in the room with the Division of Insurance, who's available for questions as well. And then if there are no further questions for the bill's sponsor and for her staff, we'll let them step back and we'll move on to our invited testimony. All right. Thank you. Next, we'll move to Jay Keese, who is with the Direct Primary Care Coalition from Washington, D.C. Mr. Keese, are you on the phone?
Yes, I am.
I'm sorry, I can't.
Madam Chair, if you might.
One moment.
Sit here and move it.
Mr. Keese, proceed with your presentation.
Okay, thank you very much. So I just thought we would level set a little bit about direct primary care as it exists in the rest of the country and some of the legislative history behind it. I did present it back. I don't know whether that's available, but I'll just run through.
We
some,
have it with us.
Figures. Terrific. I'll just run through some figures quickly. The history of this really does start in Washington State. With the Direct Practice Act there, after the Direct Practice Act was passed in Washington State, legislation was put in the Affordable Care Act to define direct primary care medical homes, as they were called, as being a medical service that could be offered in conjunction with qualified health plans that would meet essential health benefits requirements, allowing folks under the Affordable Care Act, whether getting their insurance through the exchanges or getting it from an employer to contract directly with a through that qualified health plan with a direct primary care practice. So basically it carved the primary care piece out of the qualified health plan and let the direct primary care practice deliver the primary care and let the insurance do what it does best, which is to, you know, sort of insure against risk and the highly unpredictable an expensive medical circumstances, acute care and hospitalization and expensive specialty care. Since then, the practices have grown. There's about 1,000 practices in 48 states around the country. The median fee is about $70 per person per month, or $165 for a family of four. And there's been lots of employer claims data over the past years that have shown savings of up to 20% of the total cost of care because things are being done in primary care where that's less expensive, and we're cutting down on downstream expenses spent in hospitalization and more expensive specialty care. And on the next slide, you'll see that since the Affordable Care Act was passed, we've passed these laws in another 25 states. That includes Georgia, which actually just passed last Thursday a very similar bill to this. So that is available to anybody, and I believe there's hot links to all the statutes on that slide. On the next slide, we talk a little bit. There's been some confusion in the past between direct primary care and concierge medicine. The primary distinction here is that with concierge medicine, typically the services that are provided, the medical services, are provided for by regular fee-for-service insurance, and an extra fee is paid for a non-covered service, typically like an executive physical or something that wouldn't be covered by a normal insurance plan. And with that, you get a higher level of access and, you know, the doctor's phone number and higher access to that, to those services. In DPC, that high level of access is included, plus the payment for all the medical care. So it's completely outside of third-party insurance reimbursement. On the next slide, you'll see a slide from a practice in Southern Pennsylvania called Core Family Practice. This is very typical of primary care practices, direct primary care practices around the country. Not only do the physicians provide primary care, but they offer their patients, who often have high deductible health plans, access to drugs and labs at greatly discounted prices. As you'll look at the prices that are listed in gray, these are typically the best price through a PBM or through, in this case, GoodRx, which is a discounted online service. And, you know, I think if you look at some glaring examples here, Lexapro, which is $113 per for a 30-day fill, can be had in a cash pay price for as little as $4.80. These are typically prices that are 95% less than the list cost of the drug, and they're offered at prices that are often less than the copay in an insurance PBM arrangement. So they're providing additional value beyond just the primary care. And on the next slide, you'll see some of the arrangements that are out there with direct primary care practices working with self-insured employers in Medicare Advantage arrangements with state and local employee funds. The state of New Jersey, for instance, the state employees are allowed to choose between an HMO, a PPO, and a direct primary care option where there will be no copays, no deductibles for any services in primary care, and then the insurance out of the state employees funds driven through Aetna and Horizon TPA are used to pay for the insurance services. And as we said, here's a little bit of data on the next slide. Doing DPC in conjunction with some large employer self-employed plans. We have Boeing that's been doing this in a couple of experiments, both in Seattle and now in Washington State, showing not only reductions of the total cost of care of up to 20%, but they're also finding that their employees who go into these arrangements are going in, are the employees, frankly, that have higher healthcare costs. They are more complex in their conditions. They may have multiple chronic conditions. They go to the doctor more often anyway, so they've really reduced their expense and their hassle factor by having a relationship with a personal primary care physician that knows their name, their health conditions, and can really take care of them in a more efficient manner than regular fee-for-service. And I'll end with the last couple of slides here, just outside of the state laws, which are, frankly, we're happy that you're addressing this. The states are addressing this state by state. There's a number of states where laws don't necessarily need to be changed, but, it's good to clarify that these practices are outside of state insurance regulation and really are medical services. The HHS has regulations that out of the Affordable Care Act that see it exactly the same way, but interpretation of the HSA eligibility rules are completely different under federal law. And there's now legislation that's been passed in the House last year and being reintroduced this year, and that would clarify that individuals with HSAs are, in fact, eligible, number one, to have a direct primary care practice, but it doesn't disqualify them, as current regulations see it, from having, from funding their HSA. And number two, that they're allowed to take that money out of the HSA and spend it. Now neither of those are options currently. The IRS has made some judgments that this is, in fact, under the strict provisions of the tax code, something that resembles a health plan or other kinds of coverage. And the law simply states now that HSA has to be paired with a high deductible health plan, and there can't be a second health plan or other coverage. So as long as the IRS looks at this as some sort of other coverage, it will not allow an individual to fund an HSA. So it's effectively barred from being compatible with DPC. We're hoping to change that. That's the major policy hurdle that's out there. I'm happy to address any questions you all might have about Medicare and Medicaid as well. There are some cross-references there, and I believe Phil Eskew's on the line who's a physician and attorney who can address some of those things. But we're really happy to be here tonight, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Are there any questions from the committee for Mr. Keese? All right, this is Representative Sponholz. I notice on your slides you have a slide that references three different studies relating to reducing healthcare costs, reducing employer claims, reduction in claims cost, and reduction in risk scores, and a reduction in hospital admissions down 28%. Could you send us the studies for each of those?
Yes, happy to.
All right. Seeing no questions, I think next we're going to move on to Phil Askew with Frontier Direct Primary Care in Wyoming.
Thank you. My name is Phil Eskew. I'm both a family physician. I do direct primary care and a DPC attorney. I've been following this movement since I finished law school in 2008. And as Jay mentioned, we do now have 26 states that have DPC defining not insurance legislation. And I've got a few comments on what was already discussed earlier, but I just wanted to remind everybody that the motivation for defining direct primary care is to save everyone headaches, and that becomes both the DPC physician and the patient, because you're taking a gray area in the law and making it more black and white, and also your own Department of Insurance, because they have better things to do than read each contract in detail for each and every DPC practice that opens up. So states that have done this well and been happy about it, they give a clear definition of what DPC is, and I think you guys have done that. You define it as outside of insurance. You have sort of what I call a double-dipping prohibition in there, which distinguishes DPC from concierge, which Jay Keith mentioned earlier. And you define the scope of services, have a few mandatory disclosures in the contract, and avoid stepping on your toes by inadvertently, say, blocking the state or an employer down the road from adopting and paying for DPC. And you've done all those things well in this draft legislation. I would say, as far as the patient protection discussion that was had earlier, my impression is that even without that provision in this bill, that department would probably still default and have jurisdiction to, you know, be involved in any kind of patient protection dispute, even when it's not explicitly stated. I would think that would already apply to a standard fee-for-service practice that might be open and independent across the state of Alaska presently. And most states have not felt the need to explicitly state that jurisdiction. In fact, I don't remember any other laws that have stated it, but I think it's probably a restatement of what's already going to apply anyway, whether that provision is included or not. So I'm not passionate about it one way or the other. The areas that I'm concerned about the most in your current draft are on page 2, where you've got the provision with a lot of reporting requirements that are coming back to the Department of Insurance. And you've modeled that after Washington's law, which is understandable, but I would point out that of the 26 states that have DPC laws, only 2 had any reporting requirements at all to the Department of Insurance, and those were Washington, which was the first state, and Oregon, which I would leave as the third state to pass legislation. The others have not found it necessary for a variety of reasons. First of all, remember that we're passing this to ease the burdens of tracking things on your own Department of Insurance, and we're stating that they really don't have jurisdiction over these types of contracts because they're not a transfer of risk, and they involve a relationship between a physician and a patient. And historically, those relationships are policed by the state medical board, and I think it would be wise to have this policed by the state medical board as well. So if you want to track data, that's fine. In fact, I like it. I try to publish on direct primary care as often as I can in the academic literature. So these reports are fun for me to read, but I think they're a burden on your own Department of Insurance. If you look at Washington's most recent report, the 2018 one, I think it's enlightening that they've had this data aggregation in place now for 10 years, and the insurance commissioner fought to have that included because he thought there were going to be a lot of patient complaints about these practices. And in 10 years, he's not had a single patient complaint. And that includes last year when Juliance, which Erica Bliss is on the line, she can tell you more about it, but they went through a rather sudden closure that was associated with a loss of funding and could have been quite a theoretical problem, but she did an excellent job with that transition, and there's still weren't any complaints listed in the report. So it's been a lot of extra work for the department that I'm not sure you want to have burdening your own. As far as Medicaid goes, 48 states already allow DPC physicians to see Medicaid patients in the sense that freedom of contract applies, and those patients are allowed to pay to join DPC practice just like any other. There are sort of strange laws in place in Kentucky and Colorado that prohibit any private contracting with a Medicaid patient in those states, DPC or otherwise. which I could get into if folks would like. But in general, I think you've made a wise move by removing the reference to Medicaid and Medicare from this bill, because the initial bill about direct primary care should be about just defining it. And if you want to do a pilot program, be it in the Medicaid space or be it with state employees, then I would do that with a second piece of legislation down the road once people sort of understand what DPC is and should be. I think that's most of what I had so far based on the comments I've heard, and I'm happy to take any questions if anybody has any.
Are there any questions? Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sir, you mentioned 48 states allow Medicaid patients to see DPC providers. How about Medicare patients?
So Medicare is a little different than Medicaid. Medicaid, you as a physician, you either raise your hand and sort of sign up and say you want to participate or not. Mm-hmm. And in some states under Medicaid, you can be, quote, participating, meaning credentialed and enrolled, and still have the freedom to privately contract. And in other states, they ask, they say, well, if you want to privately contract, we would rather you not formally enroll in Medicaid. So that answer varies a little bit by state in terms of the how you approach this, and that's more of a question for the physician. It doesn't really affect the patients. When it comes to Medicare, it's different. In order to privately contract for covered services under Medicare, as a physician, you need to do something called opting out. And when you do that, it's a different kind of application. You're still credentialed with Medicare. Medicare still follows your orders on patients. But you have promised Medicare that you are not going to charge them. And by making that promise and by having your patient sign a contract saying they're not going to seek reimbursement from Medicare, mm-hmm. you now have the ability to privately contract with each other for services that Medicare covers.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just wanting to ask you about this mention you made of the report and that you were saying that only two states require this, but I think Alaska, I think of our healthcare system as being so fragile relative to other places because of the uniqueness of our state in so many ways and so few providers and things like that. So in my mind, that would be helpful so that we could be able to answer questions related to, for example, a pilot program about Medicaid. We'd have a better sense of mm-hmm. who's participating, things like that. But I just wonder if you have any additional thoughts on that in terms of, this being overly burdensome, I guess, for providers. That's kind of your feeling?
Right. I mean, so remember, part of the reason DPC physicians become DPC physicians is that they want to spend more face-to-face time with the patient. And they are used to having to track a lot of things in healthcare, not only in their documentation, but in any number of pieces of paperwork that they have that really don't do any meaningful improvement in patient care. So if you want to track data, as a researcher, I have my own website, DPC Frontier, and it's free, open access. There's a mapper on there that I've been putting practices in since 2014. And that's how I can tell you. I know that there's over 1,000 practices across the country in 48 states, including Alaska. We're only missing the Dakotas. And each of these practices is sort of in there of their own volition. They don't pay anything to be in there. And the thing to remember is, I like seeing this data. I like publishing it. But if you want to track data, really, I would encourage you to be very specific about what you want and specific about where you want to house it. So right now, the way I read the bill, the burden on aggregating it is on the Department of Insurance, which I think is a strange decision since you're saying this is not insurance. So I would put the burden on someone else, maybe the State Medical Board or somebody there if you want to aggregate the data. And I would be specific about what you want them to track. Right now you've got a statement in there that sort of gives the insurance commissioner carte blanche to add lots of additional requirements and, mm-hmm. and things that must be tracked and could become quite burdensome in theory.
A follow-up?
Mm-hmm.
And are you suggesting then that this would discourage, this is a new program in Alaska, are you thinking it could discourage providers from participating if we put some additional reporting requirements on it based on the model being geared towards limiting that kind of administrative work?
I suppose if the if the burdens became great enough, then they might not sign up. Because remember, without this legislation, we default to what we have now, which is, you know, you've already got DPC practices in the state, and they're just, they've done their own due diligence, hopefully, and they've got a nice contract drafted. And if there's an audit by the Department of Insurance, then there is. So if this becomes too burdensome, if you, let's say, theoretically, if this grew and had 50 different pieces of reporting requirements and it took a long time to fill out and to track, and they may not have software to track some of the things you want them to track, then, yeah, they might not sign up and then go ahead and open a DPC practice, and then you have to deal, or the insurance commissioner, I guess, has to deal with theoretically auditing them, which is something that you're trying to avoid by defining this in the first place.
Okay. Thank you.
I'll just point out that the requirements that so far are in the bill are very limited. They require people who participate in a direct care agreement to report the number of healthcare providers in the practice, the number of patients the practice has the capacity to serve, the number of patients who entered in or who had maintained a direct primary care agreement in the practice in the in the previous calendar year, and the fee paid. And any practice that doesn't have this available readily seems to me that they shouldn't be in business anyway. So
I would agree that those metrics are easy to do. The biggest problem is C4, where it says other information requested by the division.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. So I want to back up to how many other states allow Medicaid payments for direct care agreements?
So there are some states that have Medicaid pilots in place.
Mm-hmm.
I can pull those up and give those to you. I know Michigan was the first one to enact that. And Washington State, Erica, if she's still on the call, could tell you about a pilot program they had, which was organized through Centene in part, which was a Medicaid managed care group. But what I would say is most of them have not formalized a Medicaid payment for DPC. And when they did, they did it with various different efforts. So Washington's effort was different than Michigan's current effort. Some states, I don't know what the situation is in Alaska. I don't know if you use managed care or if you run the program sort of in-house yourself.
We don't have managed care in Alaska currently.
Okay. Then I think that gives you a little bit more flexibility, maybe. One of the most interesting efforts I saw, it did not pass this year, but they're going to bring it up next year. Oklahoma State said, look, we've got all these different DPC practices. We think there's a lot of savings for patients joining them. At the same time, we're not sure that they would sign up for us to pay them for fear that this would turn this sort of selective marriage of DPC back into the old arranged marriage of capitation. So how can we take advantage of this? And what they contemplated was having a reimbursement system where they would pay back the patient maybe a portion of the monthly fee when they got the patient to send the state their invoice from the practice. So a voucher-type food stamp system, if you will, for healthcare was what Oklahoma was debating. But there are a variety of ways the state could encourage Medicaid patients to do it. I guess my overall comment would be, even if you take no action on the Medicaid front right now, unless your Medicaid provider manual has some unexpected provision in it, then physicians will be able to find a way to see Medicaid patients should they choose to join a DPC practice and pay for care on their own.
All right. Are there any other questions from Mr. SQ? All right. Thank you very much for your testimony today. Next, we're going to go to Dr. Erica Bliss with Equinox Primary Care in Seattle.
Hello.
Hi. You want to introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony?
Yes. So I'm Erica Bliss. I'm a family doc, and I was the CEO of a company called QLiance for a number of years in Washington. I would just like to echo mainly what Jay Keese and the two previous folks, Phil and Phil Eskew, have just testified. I have largely, we were active in getting the initial and then subsequent amended laws passed in Washington and things have operated fairly well since then. I would echo what Phil said about the monitoring process in Washington, that I think it's been, it's been going on now for well over 10 years, and I think it has not been terribly useful for anybody. It would be my opinion on the process. I think that was sort of, as he said, was designed to try to make sure that there were not folks trying to take advantage of consumers or game the system or anything like that, which were largely concerns raised by the insurance companies early on, who I think were concerned that we were going to try to set up, get some, early HMOs, camel's nose under the tent, that sort of thing, which was really not the intention. And you can see by the development of VPC around the country, has not come to fruition. Truly, these are practices and organizations that are trying to revive primary care and create a business model that allows for a care model that, allows for the kind of flexibility and time that we really need to be able to take care of our patients. I would just sort of underscore that it's really not a great use of resources or time, and I don't think much has been done with the information. We just simply haven't gone back to the legislature to try to get that requirement removed, just because people are busy running their practices and doing other things. There hasn't really been the energy behind it to go and get that removed, and the insurance commissioner hasn't asked to have it removed. I think that you can be fairly well assured that if you do approve this and get DPC going in this way, you can be pretty comfortable that folks will be pretty well protected, and they still have plenty of avenues to approach if they have a problem with these practices. I think I'll also say that, while QLiance is no longer in existence, we closed our doors in spring of 2017. It's growing across the country steadily. And I just attended a meeting in San Francisco of direct primary care practices from around the country. And it's impressive how much more quickly the practices grow once they open than they used to. But that they are still, someone earlier made the comment that there still is really a market and a need for this among folks who don't really have access to insurance, or who their insurance is not really adequate for them, or they find that their insurance-based primary care is not really adequate to meet their needs. I still practice in a direct primary care practice. I'm now in solo practice in Seattle. And I still find that this is the only way that I can adequately provide comprehensive, thorough primary care to my patients. And I still find that it attracts and keeps patients who generally have significant medical issues, and they come to me because I can spend the time I need with them. I don't have the hassles of billing insurance to get paid. It doesn't force me to try to jam more appointments into my day in order to make enough money to pay the bills. I can sort of set prices at a level that makes sense for me to run my business, to be able to offer the services that I have promised to my patients, that's at a price that they agree to and can afford. And I will say that I don't think my practice is unique in that it attracts a wide range of socioeconomic levels. I have patients who are very, very economically deprived, all the way to very, very wealthy patients. And some of my economically deprived patients manage to pay the full rate, and that's fine with them. Others are heavily discounted. Some folks are doing fine, and then they run into trouble, and I work out either a payment plan with them or a discount. But it's up to me and the patient to do that, to help them maintain their access to care. It's not up to whether or not they have insurance, whether they can maintain their continuity of primary care. So oftentimes, this ends up being their continuous access to care when they gain and lose work or on and off of eligibility for Medicaid or you name it. This becomes the constant, which is what primary care should be. The last comment I'll make, in case there are any questions from anybody, Q-Liance was the first direct primary care organization to undertake a large-scale Medicaid program pilot. And in Washington State, unlike Alaska, we had, by the time we entered into this, gone to a largely Medicaid managed care kind of environment. And we undertook just before the implementation of the ACA and then large scale in 2014 with the implementation of ACA, we took on probably all told in the combination of Medicaid and exchange patients, you know, probably two-thirds Medicaid, one-third exchange, a grand total of 35,000 members under that program. And while, you know, ultimately it did not go well due to problems with the Medicaid managed care companies' handling of it and lack of controls at the state level of the way that the managed care companies deal with providers, the program went very, very well. We actually had lots of data showing that we were able to significantly reduce the cost of care for our Medicaid recipients. And the sicker they were, you know, the more sort of chronic and disabled the patients were, the more dramatic the improvement was and the more dramatic the cost reductions were. On the patient side, they absolutely loved it. They said this was the best care they'd ever had. They couldn't believe the level of service. They loved being able to go to a private clinic alongside everybody else and be treated with, you know, same kind of care and concern as our other patients. We had enormous successes in getting people better. We got quite a few people actually off of Medicaid and back to work. I think that that probably didn't mesh well with the goals of some of the managed care folks. And unfortunately, it's sort of perverse incentives in some cases. But, you know, I think in your case, in Alaska, you might want to really think about it since you still have a direct contracting relationship with providers. This could be a really interesting opportunity for you where there isn't an insurance company essentially in between you and the providers. You could potentially create a really nice incentive for folks to want to do Medicaid where they're paid a probably more reasonable monthly fee and incentivized to really take great care of these folks and really dig in with them and take care of them over time. Because I think that at least our initial foray into it was very successful in that regard. Unfortunately, you know, that ended up being a large part of the reason for the demise of our company. We kind of over-invested in our Medicaid plan, a Medicaid pilot, and relied too heavily on reassurances of the plan and the state. But be that as it may, it was still very much worthwhile. And I still take care of some of those Medicaid patients today who just pay me privately and separately. So with that, I'll stop and ask if there are any questions.
Thanks for your testimony today, Dr. Bliss. Are there any questions for Dr. Bliss from the committee? Representative Tarr?
Thank you. You had said earlier and then in that last comment about the patients who couldn't pay. And so I'm trying to understand that relationship. You have the ability to, as the business owner, plan out the finances of the business and have some control over how many individuals you would be able to give a discounted rate or otherwise help out. Is that how that works?
That's correct. And it's actually an age-old tradition in medicine that has largely gone by the wayside, where it used to be that practices sort of were expected to do a certain amount of charity care. It was always sort of a given that you were going to give away your care to a certain number of people. And with the advent of, I remember actually in my training in California, when I was rotating with an HMO provider who had to, he I won't, you know, obviously reveal who it was or where it was, but he had a secret chart for a woman who had been his patient for a long time who he could no longer see and wasn't allowed to offer her charity care because of his HMO contracts. And so he was sort of going around the system on the side, but it, you know, if it had been discovered by the plans, he could have lost his contract. So, you know, that's the degree to which insurance contracting has interfered with doctors' ability to give away their care when they want to. And under this arrangement, DPC providers are back in the situation where they can say, you know, look, Mrs. Smith, I know you can't pay. It's okay. You've been my patient forever. Don't worry about it. Or, look, I'll only charge you $10 a month. Come on and continue to be my patient, and I want to make sure you get care. And that's it.
You follow? Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you for being a doctor who's willing to give charity care, because so many people need care. And so under that arrangement, you know, it's just based then on the finances of your own business that, you know, you have the ability to take 10 charity care patients or something like that. But then does that extend because there were some benefits, for example, with prescriptions and things like that? I mean, I guess then the person would need to pick up those individual costs. The part you'd be able to discount would be the actual service you provide as the medical professional.
That's correct. And the other benefit of this practice model is that because I have control over the economics of my practice, I can choose to spend my time and the time of my staff to advocate for patients, to look for better prices for them. Some practices around the country have gone so far as to negotiate their own deals with community providers, and they've gotten great rates on, sort of package deals, for example, on radiology studies. Some practices have gone so far as to pre-purchase a whole bunch of radiology studies and resell them. I mean, state by state, you have to, it depends on what the laws are, but, you know, depending on what state they're in, they're able to do sometimes things like that. So, depending on the situation you're in, and the state's regulations, DPC doctors have been able to advocate on behalf of their patients to get them the lowest possible cost care and discount what they are able to discount themselves when it's needed.
Okay. Are there others who have questions? Because I just have one more if I have the opportunity. Okay, thank you. I have one more because just thinking most of my life I haven't had health insurance, and I've been trying to rely on high deductible or the emergency plans. And to get something that's in the price range that the individual is paying per month under these plans, you generally have a really substantial deductible. And I'm just trying to sort of like connect the dots between the economics of these two different things that, you know, if a plan that doesn't cover very much really in the way of, or oftentimes anything in the way of sort of preventative care or your primary care needs, you get for say $70 to $100 a month still has this large deductible versus what you're saying, you know, is in that similar price range and you're able to provide all these benefits. And so I'm just trying to understand how they can basically cost the same but provide such different access to health care.
Yeah, so I think it's a little bit apples and oranges. So on the one hand, what you're talking about is essentially a catastrophic insurance plan, right, mm-hmm. where you've got coverage in case something terrible happens, which is really what insurance is generally about. You're trying to insure against something terrible happening. You're insuring against a flood ruining your house, right? You don't ever want it to happen, but if it does, you want some protection. And if you buy as good of insurance as you can afford, right? So if you can't afford very generous coverage, you buy the slimmest thing you can possibly buy. And if you can find something for $100 a month in this day and age that gives you any health coverage, more power to you, because down here in Washington State, the cheapest thing you can find that offers bare bones coverage is minimum like $300 a month. So, but with a huge deductible. The difference of what we're talking about is you're actually purchasing care. You're purchasing a membership, essentially, in a practice that provides you with on-demand primary care. So, for example, it's basically all your preventive and primary care needs when you need them and in the way that you need them. I just this morning I saw a brand new patient and was explaining this to her, and I said, you know, I do need to see you in person to establish care, but after that, it's up to us to figure out whether I need to see you in person, whether we can do things over the phone, whether we can do a video visit, whether we can do things by, you know, electronic visits, patient portal, that kind of thing. Whatever is the most effective, efficient way to do it, we're going to do that. And that really lowers costs for both the patient and the provider. And it fits, you know, helps to, you know, I think help people understand why I can do what I do for, say, $70 a month or $80 a month. I can make myself available when people are, you know, paying that membership fee every month. I can make myself fairly available, and I can be on call for myself all the time, because that ends up being a decent amount of revenue every month that I can then plan my availability, I can plan my staffing, I can plan my resources. And so it doesn't matter to me if 1 month you need to see me three times a week because you have a very significant acute problem, or you don't need me for 3 months except you have a few questions and you ping me, you know, electronically. Or, you know, 1 month you need me in the middle of the night, so you call me. That's the benefit of having a subscription-type program, is that I don't have to sit there and charge you and think about what's the cost of providing this little individual service. And you don't have to think about, oh, gosh, do I call her because it's going to cost me. You've already paid for it, and it sort of lowers the barrier to care and encourages people to use primary care early and often. Then it gives me a chance to help that patient avoid unnecessary complications. It helps me help you avoid the ER and avoid surgeries and avoid specialists and avoid CT scans and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I always tell people my job is to keep you out of trouble so that hopefully you never touch your insurance. Ideally, that would be great, right? Or maybe we just use it for the colonoscopy once every 10 years or the mammogram every couple years or, you know, a couple of things like that. So it actually couples very nicely with that. So my final point would be, if you could think of it as $70 a month for direct primary care and $70 to $100 a month if you can find it for a, you know, catastrophic plan, if you can afford that, you've actually got pretty decent health care and health coverage.
Perfect. Thank you.
All right. And you've got someone to help you navigate the system, too, which you don't get when you just buy the insurance.
So, and for some context, I'm looking at the 2018 annual report to the legislature in Washington on healthcare, direct healthcare practices, and it looks like the average monthly fee is between about $60 and $100 a month per person, although you can have a much higher fee. If you are interested in a fancier practice, I can imagine there's a Bellevue address for a Bellevue location for one of those. For anybody who's lived in Washington, you know what that means. But I wanted to ask a question for you, Dr. Bliss, around the reporting, because as I'm looking at the reporting requirements as described in Washington State, it says that, you know, that direct care practices have to submit an annual statement to the Office of the Insurance Commissioner saying the number of providers in the practice, the number of patients, the average fee, and the name of the direct practice providers and the business address. What is so onerous about that reporting? Is there something that I'm missing about what makes that process onerous? Because I actually find that as somebody who's considering introducing this policy to the state of Alaska, having this information for me is very useful.
Yeah, it's not onerous. It's really more, sort of our objection originally was we felt like it really has nothing to do with the insurance commissioner because it's not insurance. This is not insurance. It's a business providing medical care and therefore should be governed by, you know, whatever body in that state governs commerce for the business side. And then you presumably already have whatever body is governing the medical quality of the medical practice, which is the malpractice side of it, and, you know, hence the discussion earlier today. So when we first came to the legislature in Washington, we said, you know, our point is that not all healthcare has to come under the rubric of insurance. And we're trying to kind of educate folks that this is part of the problem as we think about all health care as being insurance, and it's not. Health care is health care, and health insurance is a mechanism to protect people against risk. That's all it really is. But we have meshed the two together in this country to the point where people don't even understand the difference. Yeah. So what we were trying to say was, if you want reporting so you can understand the delivery of health care, then fine, have the Department of Health study it, but not the Insurance Commission, because it's not insurance.
All right, I thought you were making the argument earlier that it was onerous, and I believe that Mr. Askew also suggested that that the reporting was onerous, and so I wanted to sort of niggle into that, and it sounds like perhaps you're saying now that it's not that it's onerous, it's just that it's in the wrong place.
Right, and it's onerous in the sense that it's onerous because it's not being put to good use, and it sort of perpetuates the notion that all things have to eventually roll up into insurance. I think most of us would love to see the departments of health in our states or legislators, assign some other body to say, hey, let's look at the system of delivery of care and let's take this seriously as a piece of the delivery system and study it as such.
All right, thank you. Representative Jackson?
Thank you, through the chair. I look at this as old-fashioned doctor-patient care before insurance blew up, right, when they did house calls. So I understand the statement of having to report anything to insurance companies is there's no place for it, really, because this is not insurance. It's a business with healthcare professionals to their patients. But I understand what you're saying. If the state want records of any kind, it going under the state medical board is where it should go. Is that correct?
Are you asking me?
Yes. So, yeah. And
yeah, I think that would be a good place for it. Yes.
And
follow up.
Thank you. Follow up. So to have a program like this, I can see where it would attract more doctors if they didn't have to go through the rigorousness of insurance. Would you agree?
I think that's very true. In my experience, when I was running Q Alliance for 10 years, I traveled around the country. I spoke extensively in front of many, many different audiences of doctors, medical students, pre-med students, residents, you name it. And almost 100% of the time, the response was, wow, this sounds like the kind of medicine I was hoping I was going to do and not getting to do it. And I even had medical students say at one point, you know, this is cutting edge medicine to be able to do primary care where you got to actually really use all the skills that you trained to do and were able to really provide the full scope of care to your patients and really engage. That sounded really exciting to them, and they, you know, said, this makes me want to really do primary care because it sounds great, you know, and it sounds really intellectually engaging. It sounds very satisfying in terms of being able to help people, which is what I kind of wanted to do when I went into medicine, et cetera. I talked to doctors who have been in practice in the fee-for-service system for many years, and to a person, none of them are saying, well, no, I really love doing fee-for-service insurance-based healthcare, and I can't imagine wanting to do what you do. They all say, boy, I'm jealous. I wish I could do what you do. Now, they may not be willing to take the chance since this is still, we're still in the minority, mm-hmm. They may not want to take the risk of doing it, but none of them say, what you're doing sounds terrible. They all say it sounds marvelous and wonderful, and I wish I could do that with my patients.
Thank you. All right. Any other questions for Dr. Bliss? All right. Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony today. Next up, we have a testimony from the Washington State Office of the Insurance Commissioner. We have Candace Myram and Mandy Weeks Green.
Hi, good afternoon.
Hello. Can you introduce yourself for the record?
Yes, my name is Mandy Weeks Green. I'm a senior health policy analyst here at the Washington Office of the Insurance Commissioner.
All right, great. Great. You want to proceed with your testimony?
Yes. As a part of my responsibilities, I review and approve direct practice registrations. I refer cases for enforcement when there are non-compliant practices, and I conduct ongoing monitoring of direct practices. We thought it would be helpful to best discuss parts of Washington laws that protect consumers the best and discuss areas we think we would strengthen for better consumer protection. You know, as background, there was a lot of discussions about risk shifting.
Ms. Weeks-Green, are you perchance on speakerphone? It's a little difficult to hear you.
I am. Is it better?
That is much better. Thank you so much.
Sure. No problem. Do I need to go back at all?
No, I think you can proceed.
Okay. Sounds great. Thank you. Just for background, we consider direct practices to be insurance unless they qualify for the exception for insurance. So it's not that all direct practices are an exception, but if you apply and you are conducting your business within the bounds of the statute, then you do qualify for the exception. But many practices don't qualify. Many practices aren't initially operating within those bounds, like they haven't applied for permission from the OIC, or they are doing other activities that are not legal within the insurance, are not legal within the boundaries of direct practice laws that we currently have. And so we help them get into compliance and then get that exception.
So in Washington State, you're saying you have to apply to be accepted from insurance?
Yes, you apply for registration.
Okay, thank you.
Before operating a direct practice.
Okay, thank you.
And that's really one of our most important for protections for consumers is the requirement for registration before a direct practice operates. Because this enables the OIC to review direct practitioners' application and contract and marketing materials before these services are offered to consumers. It's the best time for us to intervene and help make corrections to prevent consumers from being harmed and ensure compliance with the direct practice laws. For example, we've been able to rent a number of billing structures that were based on a person's health status, such as charging higher fees for consumers with certain conditions or chronic conditions. Washington has a general prohibition on discrimination, but we also have a specific prohibition to prevent billing based on fees that are based on a person's health status. Huh. Washington also restricts a provider's reasons for declining or terminating a patient. This helps us when reviewing contracts to ensure that consumers are properly advised of their rights around termination. When reviewing applications, I've seen a number of contracts reserving the right to terminate or accept patients for any reason or decline to accept patients for any reason. And we have worked with those practices to revise their language to reflect the lawful language requirements. And on the financial side, Washington law has been very helpful in setting limitations around billing, cancellation, and retaining unused fees. Direct practices typically bill on a monthly basis in advance for the month. As a result, our law requires a refund for the prorated unused fees from the date the provider was notified of cancellation. Having this provision has enabled us to remove a number of clauses in direct practice contracts that sought to retain the money through the contract period. We've also been able to prevent direct practices from charging consumers cancellation fees. Additionally, if a provider would like to collect money for more than a month in advance, our statutes say that, like, it's, for example, if you'd like to set it on an annual fee basis, then a trust account must be set up to retain the collected money and ensure that those fees are still only withdrawn from the account on a monthly basis. There are also several requirements that must be contained within the contract, which were developed to protect consumers. One of the most important clauses that are required to be in contracts is that the contracts must encourage the consumers to retain insurance or purchase supplemental plans to cover emergencies.
Ms. Weeks-Green, we have a couple of questions in the queue here.
Of course.
Representative Zelkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Weeks-Green, can you, these are some really interesting and comprehensive types of consumer protections that some of us have been, at least I can speak for myself, that I have been concerned in making sure that we protect Alaskans as we consider this proposal. Can you talk about what type of resources are needed within the Washington Office of Insurance to uphold these types of protections and to be able to provide the work that you're describing?
I am the sole person that manages drug practices, and it's only a portion of my duties. It's a small portion because I'm a healthcare policy analyst, so it does not take me an exceptional amount of time to review a contract, communicate with a provider, discuss needed changes. I think really what may involve more time is when we have unlicensed, unregistered entities out there offering a number of services that that are inappropriate under the statute. And so that does involve some investigative time and some additional resources, but primarily it's not very much.
Follow up? Thank you. Are you able to provide a written copy? Apologies if you have already submitted it, and maybe it's just not in my binder, but are you able to provide a written copy of the testimony that you're reviewing with us today?
Yeah, I would be happy to.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Clayman? Representative, yeah, if you could send in what you've got, that would be helpful, what you've got prepared for your notes, that would be helpful. Representative Clayman?
Thank you, Madam Chair. You've given us a copy of the Washington statutes. Are there also regulations that have been issued that relate to this, or is everything in statute?
Everything is in statute. We don't currently have any regulations.
And follow up?
Mm-hmm.
And so as I understand it, even though this is technically not insurance, the Washington legislature effectively decided that it should be treated, that it would be subject to insurance department supervision as opposed to the Consumer Protection Division?
So that is a very interesting question, and I think that goes back to the history, and that's very technical, but this is insurance if you look at it from the definition of insurance. Because insurance is risk shifting, which means that you you accept the risk of whether or not you're going to go, you or the client are going to receive more benefits or less benefits from the contract. So if I'm a doctor, I may receive more payment from the patient based on a monthly basis. If I just bill on a monthly basis, they may not come see me for 3 months. So I would be receiving the benefit of that contract. The risk shifting comes when the patient may actually utilize the service more than you've accounted for.
Do you have a follow-up, Representative Clayman?
I thought you were still talking. I do have a follow-up. So you actually are specifically in Washington define these agreements as a form of an insurance agreement, whereas at least the proposal we have would specifically say that it's not an insurance agreement.
It is an insurance agreement
in Washington.
It's accepted from the insurance code as long as everything's done appropriately. So we accept it from regulation as long as everything's operating smoothly.
Thank you.
Representative Jackson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So would you consider, you say that direct primary care is in insurance, but technically it is a service between a medical provider and a patient. Does this threaten the insurance industry in any way? Is it competitive?
I don't know that it's as competitive as you, I don't know that that's the underlying element of why we regulate them. Like we are concerned about them because they can cause consumer harm when they're not operated appropriately and within the bounds. I do not believe that insurance companies are necessarily threatened by the practice of direct practices. I do think that you might be pulling more healthier people out of the market into direct practices. But we don't know anything about that necessarily because we're not able to get into any studies on that.
Follow up.
So would you say, you say insurance is in it to protect the patient. Wouldn't that be the purpose of the state medical board? to make sure the doctors are licensed and they are who we think they are and have the qualifications we hope they have?
Well, we can report to the state medical board. So any violation of the insurance code is also a violation of any violation here under the direct practice statute is also a violation under the ethics board of the medical board. So we do have the ability to cooperate together for investigation.
Follow?
So I think you may misunderstood with what I was trying to say. That I'm trying to say, instead of insurance looking out for the concerns and safety of the people, couldn't the medical board do that? Do they need insurance to do that?
Do you mean the office of the insurance
commissioner? Yes, yes.
This is where it landed. We do consider it insurance. It isn't a pay-for-service model. It isn't I pay my provider $10 to go see them. You know, it's one thing if you wanted to charge your patients a nominal fee and say, okay, I want to operate a low-income clinic and I will charge you $5. And those $5 equal an $80, you know, could add up to $80 a month. It is another thing when you say, I'm going to take the risk that you may or may not use this service.
Mm-hmm. Follow up.
One more.
Yes, thank you. That's exactly what it's doing. Just like when I purchase a extra maintenance plan on my vehicle, I realize that I may not use it, but if I need it, it's there. So that would be the choice of the patient.
Right. That's insurance, too.
Yeah. All right. I have one question, and then Representative Clayman has another question. In looking at the 2018 Washington State Report on Direct Care Practices, it looks like there's over 18,000 direct practice enrollees in 2018. You said that that the Office of the Insurance Commissioner had found some contracts that were not in compliance with state law. How many, I don't have the number of practitioners right in front of me, but how many, out of the number of practitioners you have, how many contracts did you find that are sort of problematic on an annual basis?
We don't receive that many, which is why it doesn't involve a lot of my time. My guess is we receive...
it looks like there's 41 direct practices in the state of Washington right now, so it's not that many.
Those are continuing to operate. So yeah. I maybe receive 5 applications a year.
Okay.
I mean, those are people who are applying, and we suspect that there's a large number of entities that are not applying with the OIC and are operating without a permission to operate.
Mm-hmm.
But the number is very low. The number of practices applying is very low, but the number of practices that have clauses within their contract that create some problem with the direct practice statute is fairly high. I have conversations with about 50 to 75% of direct practitioners to help them resolve their contractual issues.
All right. That's very interesting.
Just to protect consumers.
Yeah, that's helpful.
During the registration process. And it's usually very, as long as they're coming in before they're operating, it's usually very easy. We discuss it. I review the law. I talk to them about, like, why it doesn't fit within the law confines or why it could harm consumers. And they usually just say, great, I'll make the change.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Clayman.
I just want to make sure I understood. Is it the case that if they have this insurance for the direct practice, are they also required to have another layer of insurance behind that as part of Washington's insurance coverage requirements?
No, we just require them to encourage people to have an emergency plan, like a high deductible health plan.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Are there any other questions for Ms. Weeks Green? All right, we don't have any additional questions for you. Did you have any additional testimony you wanted to make? I did interrupt you earlier, so.
Oh, yeah, if I could, I think most importantly I wanted to note that we are seeing a changing landscape of direct practices. We're seeing more and more innovation and expansion into new models of direct practice bundling with non-primary care services, bundling and discounts on services with labs, providers, and pharmacies. And we're even seeing entities that are trying to create direct care practice network and network plans. Along these lines, an important part of Washington law is that we prevent employer direct practice plans. And despite this, we receive a number of consumer complaints about employer-based direct practice plans and have discovered a large number of entities that are offering these plans without being registered. Mm. We didn't expect, I think when we reviewed our laws, when our laws were written, we didn't expect this change in technology and this change in innovation. And we are currently receiving an application for direct practice that isn't located in Washington, but would like to provide telemed primary care services entirely to consumers. Mm-hmm. So I think it's important to note that these innovations and expansions are not coming from registered direct practices or networks. The consumer complaints are not about those practices. And many of these entities have never sought approval from the OIC to operate or our guidance. I believe that if Washington was able to foresee these changes happening in direct practice, we likely would have set more parameters around permissible direct practice structures. Mm-hmm. While it once seemed like a small number of providers, it's exploded due to innovation and technology, and it's probably going to continue. So we hope this helps you prepare to address these changes and innovations in the direct practice, because it helps you to preserve that model that you envision in the future.
Ms. Weeks Green, I'm looking at the report that I referenced earlier. It says that there was 40 practices in 2017 and 41 in 2018. You just used the word exploded to describe the increase in the number of participants, and that doesn't sound like exploding to me. Would you like to explain what you mean?
Yeah, I think that there's a large number of plants operating out there that are operating outside OIC's, without OIC's permission.
All right. Is there anything that the Office of the Commissioner is doing about that?
Yes, we are. We're looking into them. So this is the first that we're learning of these other entities, and we get consumer reports on a regular basis. We don't tend to track the consumer reports, just as a clarification. We don't put the consumer complaints in our reports if they're not about licensed drug practices. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the complaints are about unlicensed entities, so you won't see those numbers in the actual report that we file with the legislature. And we're just seeing a lot of new models and new innovation that we are not seeing before, but they're not from entities that are contacting us. It's usually we're hearing about it from consumer complaints, or we're hearing about it from other direct practices who are notifying us mm-hmm. that they're seeing this. And for us, it feels like an explosion because it feels like a rush, a lot of change happening very, very quickly.
All right, so that's primarily amongst unlicensed practices or complaints about potentially unlicensed practices. Mm-hmm. All right, thank you. Are there any other questions for Ms. Weeks Green? All right, seeing none, I want to thank you very much for your testimony. And it's, as was referenced earlier, if you can email in your comments, that would be helpful, and we'll distribute them to the entire committee. I want to thank everybody who testified on HB 92, as well as the bill sponsor and her staff, Ms. Shine. At this time, we're going to go ahead and set aside House Bill 92 for further consideration. Next week on Tuesday, we may have a committee meeting. At this time, we only have bills previously heard or scheduled on the agenda. On Thursday, we're going to be doing a hearing from individuals and organizations regarding the substance abuse treatment system in the state of Alaska. I think this is particularly timely in light of the fact that we're having a lot of discussion around crime bills, and we know that crime is significantly increased when you have substance abuse problems that aren't treated, and we're going to be exploring what is being done in the state of Alaska to address our substance abuse challenges. As well as the refinancing of substance abuse treatment that has been undertaken in the last few years. The time is 4:55, and this hearing of the House Health and Social Services Committee is now adjourned.